From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show today are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Oren Durell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. Tension between the United States and North Korea worsened amid talk of war. For the second time, a judge struck down President Trump's temporary ban on immigrants from six Muslim-majority countries. Four Russians, including two of them government officials, were indicted in the United States for hacking the Silicon Valley company Yahoo, and President Trump proposed to slash domestic spending in the United States to help pay for a military buildup. Well, I'll have to say, Tom, that the talk about war, even nuclear war, may be exaggerated, but it is more worrisome talk than I've heard in a long time. What's going on here, other than the new Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is on a trip to the Far East, and he announced that after 20 years, American policy toward North Korea has failed.
Meaning diplomacy has failed. Carrots and the threat of a stick has failed, giving the North Koreans nuclear reactors if they'll behave. That hasn't worked. And so I think it's part of a strategic plan by the Trump administration to put more pressure on the North Koreans and also to put more pressure on the Chinese, because it's not a coincidence, Fred, that people around Secretary Tillerson are saying anonymously that, well, maybe we have to not only increase our troop presence in South Korea, but maybe we need to talk about adding a few more nuclear weapons in South Korea, and maybe we ought to talk about nuclear weapons for Japan, which would be calculated to really drive everybody crazy, not just the North Koreans, who are already crazy, but the Chinese, who would be nervous about anything like that. So it's kind of it's what I would call non-diplomacy diplomacy. They're hoping that by rattling a few sabers that the North Koreans will come to their senses. I don't think they will, and I don't think the U.S. government thinks they will, but they're hoping that maybe the Chinese, with these sorts of veiled threats, will lean on the North Koreans. I think that's going to be difficult, because I think the North Koreans think nuclear weapons are the only thing that keeps them in the game, and I don't think they're going to be persuaded by anything less than a military intervention in North Korea. I do not see that happening. It sounds pretty extreme, but I think that's the only thing that can probably solve this problem in the long run.
Oren, give me a little background here. Why has the policy failed? I mean, some people think, well, we've tried to appease the North Koreans and offer them some things. Tom mentioned a little of that. And the United States could continue doing that, but that's not what the new Secretary of State has announced.
Well, there's more than one dynamic at work here. One is an internal North Korean dynamic where they see, as Tom says, they see these nuclear weapons as a preservative for their ability to stay in power. But the broader picture is that the Chinese see North Korea as a buffer state between its forces, the United States forces, and South Korea. And they want that friendly, you know, or cantankerous state to remain there and to be a buffer. Anything that happens that would force the North Koreans to abandon their nuclear weapons, be it a military attack or a sanctions that are strong enough to bring down the regime, to destabilize the regime, the Chinese see that as a double threat. First of all, they don't want to have an economic mayhem created by refugees crossing the border into China. And also, they don't want American and South Korean forces on their own border. So their main goal is to keep this regime in power. The North Koreans know it. And the Chinese are key to what happens in North Korea, but they don't have much of an incentive to do anything about it.
Tom, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me, and maybe it was to you as well, normally when a country like the United States announces that a policy has failed, they mention that in announcing a new policy and spelling it out. Well, this time it was just a failure of the old policy, and they haven't announced a new one.
It's because they don't have a new one yet. They're developing it. Everything in terms of the Trump foreign policy is in development beyond very strong rhetorical language by President Trump about he's going to be tough, he's going to be strong, he's going to confront aggression, he's going to rearm America, increase defense spending, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the policy is in flux, to put it mildly. We shouldn't be surprised. Trump has been president only about 2 months now, but this is a serious threat. As a matter of fact, I think I've said before that in President-elect Trump's first meeting with then-President Obama, President Obama told Trump that the greatest danger to world security is North Korea. And Trump said later, I learned a lot of interesting things, and one thing in particular I learned, that was one he didn't know, and that's what he was referring to. So they've had a while to start working on this, and it's probably going to take a few more months for them to consult with allies both in Europe and in Asia. So it's in flux, but they'll have to have a policy before long beyond just rhetorical saber-rattling.
One thing to remember on this North Korea story and the China story is that the areas of conflict with China are broader, much broader than North Korea. There's issues in the South China Sea that are really getting big. And, so there's going to be a lot happening in that arena.
Well, let me ask you both about the new Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has been, I wouldn't say attacked in the media, but there's certainly been stories about him, Tom, about, I don't know, maybe each of you have written these stories about how Tillerson has no experience. He's not a diplomat. He was the chairman of ExxonMobil, the oil company, for, two decades or something like that. And there have been meetings with foreign leaders or meetings on foreign policy subjects at the White House to which he seems not to have been invited, which is certainly unusual. Tom, what do you make of the new Secretary of State?
If I had to come up with a nickname, I would call him the Sphinx, because he said next to nothing, hadn't had any press conferences. He has not taken along mainstream media on this trip. As a matter of fact, he was taking no reporters until there was a real objection to that. So he added one reporter who is a very reliable right-wing conservative journalist. And so that was it. He's clearly feeling his way. But the other thing is, President Trump wants to diminish the role of the State Department in the conduct of American diplomacy. At the moment, he's running the world out of the West Wing of the White House, and that's probably a little short-sighted. We will see. But Tillerson, the other problem that Tillerson has is many of his nominees for undersecretary and assistant secretary have been rejected by the Trump White House because they're not ideologically pure enough. Mm-hmm. And so he's off to a slow start, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I would say that Tillerson might be an early candidate for cabinet departure, not immediately, but I'm just saying I wouldn't be shocked that if in 18 months Tillerson is declared victory and goes back into retirement.
Orrin, you've covered a lot of Secretary of States. What about this new one?
Well, he's different because he doesn't have any government experience, but he does have a lot of experience negotiating with other states, and especially in very inhospitable places that are often not friendly to the United States because of his business in the oil industry. But he's going to also preside over a 30% shrinkage in the State Department budget. According to if the President Trump gets his budget request, and yes, he's been kind of quiet in terms of making public statements. We'll have to see. We'll have to see what happens. One thing that I noticed was that the State Department came out with a very strong statement about Crimea, Ukraine's Crimea province that was seized and annexed by Russia, saying that the United States will never recognize Russian control of Crimea. And this was something that Tillerson had basically said. He during his confirmation hearing, he kind of held off on making a judgment about what the Russians were doing in Crimea
and what
kinds of crimes they were causing. But now he said at the time that he needed to get the intelligence briefings, and now apparently he got the intelligence briefings and he's made a very strong statement. So, we'll see.
We'll see. Okay, Tom, since you had already started talking about the the military buildup and the cut in domestic spending, which has been proposed by President Trump. This is not new. You and I have been around long enough to remember going back to when Ronald Reagan became president in 1981, and he proposed something similar to this. And the way I look at it, when you propose that you're going to have a military buildup and you're going to pay for it by cutting domestic spending and eliminating things like aid to public television and so on, you'll get some of that, but not that much. In other words, this is just the first offer by President Trump.
Right. We both know, Fred, every budget is a political budget. Every president puts out his first budget to make a statement, and the statement here by President Trump is, I'm keeping yet another promise. I promised that 36% of the United States that loves him and will love him no matter what he does, whether he succeeds or fails, he's saying to them, I'm keeping my promises. I'm going to drain the swamp. Well, the term of art in the American vernacular is dead on arrival. I think this budget is dead on arrival, and I think most of the Trump people understand that. You cannot, I mean, the notion that he's going to cut 29% from the State Department budget, that's not going to happen. The difference here, I think, between what President Reagan proposed in his first budget and in this proposed budget is that I don't recall President Reagan's budget being denounced by so many of his own. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was
struck. You mean members of his own party?
Of his own party, yes, mm-hmm. His own Republicans. I was struck by a comment by a very conservative Republican named Congressman Hal Rogers, who used mm-hmm. to be a committee chairman of the House Budget Committee, and he said after this budget is draconian, careless, and counterproductive. Now, I would have thought that would have been a Democrat saying that. I'm mm-hmm. sure Democrats have said that, but this was a senior, prominent Republican who is well-steeped in the budget. So this is not going to happen. I mean, but I agree with you. This is classic Trump. This is an opening gambit in a negotiation. Mm-hmm. He will get some of what he wants, but he's not going to get 31% mm-hmm. reductions in the Environmental mm-hmm. Protection Agency.
Orrin, I'm going to come to you in a moment, but first I'm going to remind listeners that this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me today are you, Orrin Durrell of USA Today, and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. What about this budget proposal, Orrin?
Well, first of all, just look at some of the proposals. Some of these cuts are to, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services, $12.6 billion at 16.2%. State Department, like Tom said, $11 billion, 28.7%. Education, $9 billion, 13.5%. And it just goes down the list. National Institute of Health, Housing and Urban Development. They're cutting all these programs. A lot of them are social programs. You know, when I was reading this list, it goes back to something that Trump's advisor, Steve Bannon, said, that a top priority of the president is, quote, deconstruction of the administrative state. And he said, if you look at the cabinet appointees, that's why they were chosen. This is the goal of this administration, is to dismantle a bureaucracy, what they see as a bureaucracy that mm-hmm. costs a lot of money and doesn't do a lot of good. But there are a lot of people in Congress that, you know, obviously the Democrats are really against this. They're saying that they're going to block it wherever they can. But also a lot of, you know, Paul Ryan came out and said he was pretty supportive of it, the Speaker of the House. But other GOP lawmakers said that they're going to resist it, including, you know, Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. You know, he wants to defend a program. There's a lot of these, like, individual programs, like, for mm-hmm. he wants to protect the Great Lakes. And there are a lot of individual programs that are specific to individual states that people are going to try to protect, or regions. And when it comes to foreign policy, the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, the foreign affairs chairman, Bob Corker, both of them said that, you know, that this is not happening in terms of the cuts to foreign affairs.
Tom?
One of the more interesting numbers to me, Fred, is agriculture. There are a lot of breathtaking numbers here, but this budget proposes cutting 21%, one-fifth of the budget for the Department of Agriculture. And there are a lot of powerful lobbies in this town, the gun lobby, the Jewish lobby, I mean, the Friends of Israel lobby, whatever. But there is a built-in constituency in this country for agriculture, for farmers, and the farm lobby is a very powerful one. And there is no way that the Agriculture Department's budget is going to be cut by 21%. That's not going to happen. So, again, I go back to this is a political document like every first-term president's first budget, and we'll see how much he gets. He'll get some, but he won't get anywhere near this.
Okay.
And I'm sure President Trump understands that.
I suspect he does, no question about that. What about this? For the second time, President Trump has tried to institute a temporary ban on immigrants from the six Muslim-majority countries. A judge struck it down, I thought, on unusual grounds, Warren, and that was, he said, it basically is the judge didn't like what he said were President Trump's motives. He cited some quotes from the president and people who worked for the president in the past saying that he, President Trump, or then was a candidate and so on, didn't want more Muslims to come into the country. And this clashed with a more conservative view of what the judge should have done, and that is rule just on whether does the president have the authority, that the motive has nothing to do with it legally, does he have the authority to do that? Well, anyway, Trump lost.
You know, the issue of motive kind of goes to, we have this thing in the Constitution about not discriminating against people based on religion, and Donald Trump, as a candidate, said for months that he's going to block Muslims from entering the country and talked about that. And then he issued a ban that was aimed at doing that with, you know, majority Muslim countries. And that was struck down. And then he issued a revised ban, temporary ban, that his advisor said would have the same outcome as the previous one that was struck down. So if you connect those dots, you end up with the motive actually being, you know, according to the courts at least, or these judges, that the motive being very germane to the issue. Whether the president has the authority, I think that U.S. law is not supposed to be arbitrary. So, you know, I don't think that the president actually has the authority to do something that's arbitrary and without reason and that's not proven to be effective. And that's another
isn't that a policy question?
That's another thing that the judge talked about was that there's no evidence, and the previous ruling was struck down based on this also, that there's no evidence that the ban that that President Trump wants to implement would actually protect anybody.
Tom, I mean, I personally regard that as a policy question, and that's not what judges are supposed to do. Well, but my view and Donald Trump's view, we're 0-2.
I agree with you to this extent, Fred. The legal issue should be, does the president have the authority under the Constitution to ban Muslims? And if he were to do that, is that an impingement on religious freedom? Mm-hmm. And at least two courts.
Actually, more than two when you get to the appeals court.
At least three when you think of the appeals, have said the effect of President Trump's ban is to ban citizens of the world on religious grounds. And we'll see. This is one of these things that's going to continue to go on in the courts for quite some time, I think. And I'll bet you this, at some point, the White House, if they keep losing, they will take this to the Supreme Court, and it might be a Supreme Court decided by the next member of the Supreme Court later this year or even next year.
Well, that's the only way they could win. I mean, if the appeals court, and this would be the Ninth Circuit, the one out in the West Coast, that did what it did the last time, they would uphold a lower court judge. And then if it went to the Supreme Court, it would be tied, and that would uphold what the lower courts did. So I think if there's any chance for the Trump administration to do something like this, they are going to have to wait for a fifth justice, a more conservative justice, who might go along with their contention. But I don't think it looks very good for this idea of this temporary ban on these countries. Okay, well, let's mention the indictment of these Russian officials. I was struck by that. Two of them are government officials. They hacked into Yahoo and this high-tech company. One of them has actually been is not in Russia. And I mean, what happens here now? I mean, the Russians, there's no extradition treaty between the U.S. and Russia. So I think you have the indictment and then nothing happens, right?
So this is an interesting case because, first of all, it involves Russian intelligence agents who are indicted. It also involves freelancers or, you know, hackers that were not actually working, don't have badges or saying that they work for Russian intelligence, but they were working with Russian intelligence agents.
Mm-hmm.
From my understanding of this case is that unlike the DNC, the hacks of the Democratic National Convention websites and or emails and people in the Democratic presidential campaign, this was more of a profit-motivated operation. And that the one of the guys that was arrested, that's indicted, has actually been arrested by the Russians also.
Mm.
He's sitting in prison in Russia facing a charge of treason. But what he's apparently what they were doing was collecting compromising information on people and using that to either for extortion or for influence. And there was a whole mix of stuff where they were using credit card information. One of the guys was using credit card information and gift cards to buy himself things. Another guy was, other guys were using the information that they were getting to blackmail people or to embarrass them in public. So it was a whole mix of stuff, but it seems like it was more of a profit motivated, personal motivated type operation within the FSB, the Russian successor to the KGB, and not so much of a spy operation like the alleged hacking of the Democratic National Convention. But it does bring out this whole story. It brings back this whole story of Russian hacking and Russian interference in American politics and commerce. This happens to be the first time that a KGB or a FSB agent was, Russian spies were actually charged in a criminal offense regarding hacking in the United States. Usually, when it's just espionage, they consider it not really criminal.
Tom?
Well, I agree with Aaron that it's will refocus American attention on the Russians. I mean, I think the average American is not going to see much distinction between what the Russians were doing or not doing in the 2016 campaign and this. The suggestion is the Russians are up to no good,
mm-hmm.
and that cannot help President Trump. And so I think, indirectly at least, these new indictments are going to refocus American political attention on the Russian connection, however you want to define that. So that's probably not a welcome development around the White House.
Well, let me ask you both as we conclude here. This is another, it may not be as serious as an espionage case. As you said, the hacking into the Democratic National Committee mucking around in American politics, Orrin. But I think this, once again, as Tom was suggesting, makes it harder for good relationships between the United States and Russia, which Donald Trump has talked about. It's harder for that to happen.
It is harder for that to happen. And, we'll have to see what happens. But there are a lot of areas in which the Americans and the Russians are really at odds. And some of this stuff that they've been doing with the computer hacking fits into a spectrum of what they consider warfare, against the West and against the United States. And, things like collecting embarrassing information about Western politicians and publishing it mm-hmm. fits into that spectrum. And they've been doing a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what about it? Are you expecting a new era of detente?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, briefly, I think the whole notion of Secretary Tillerson saying we're not going to recognize the annexation of Crimea, these sorts of things, it suggests, and I have some reporting to back up some of this, that the Trump administration has concluded that the era of new good feeling with the Russians is mm-hmm. Probably not going to be happening.
Well, I hope somebody tells this to President Trump, because he has
he has not changed his rhetoric. That's
what
for
I meant.
Sure,
yeah.
But let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. You just heard him. And Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.